listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RBA. On today's Open Source RVA, we take you once more down Route 5 and talk with Nicole Anderson Ellis and Giles Harnsberger about the recently shelved Richmond Regional Planning District proposal. We'll also update you on the fracas between the Wingnut Collective and Richmond Police with lawyer Andrew Bodo. And we'll introduce you to the members of the RVA Beard League and chat with them about Richmond's status as a place for beards and stashes. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
Pointed in the wrong direction, someone's gonna get killed.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Current Richmond City Council President Kathy Graziano will be stepping down in the new year, as she confirmed to CBS 6 last week, though she will remain on the council. This was her second term as president, adding up to 4 years, and Graziano cited wanting to give other council members leadership opportunities as the reason she is relinquishing her role. During her years as council president, Graziano has overseen the building of schools in a new jail, the passing of budgets, and the recent Redskins deal. Her term did not go untarnished. Last year, the alleged mishandling of sexual harassment charges against her own aide, David Hathcock, had a small but vocal group of Graziano's fellow council members insisting that she step down. The 9 members of council will vote on their next president, though no one is quite sure who that will be just yet. Open Source RVA caught up with recently re-elected 2nd District Councilperson Charles Samuels to ask him about speculations that he will be making a bid for Graziano's old position.
Nothing is a guarantee, but it is something that if everything worked out, it's something I'd be interested in.
Okay. And how would you see yourself stepping up into that role? Do you have a vision?
Well, I think that's a great question. I'd rather answer that after... If that's the case, I'd rather answer that question after it happens. It seems a little premature to be saying what I would do or what someone else would do in that position when it's still 5 weeks out.
More than 2 decades ago, Brian Montgomery was crossing Brook Road near its intersection with Wilkinson Road in his wheelchair. A resident of nearby Hollybrook Apartments, he's lived for years in the subsidized apartment complex for people with disabilities in northern Henrico County. The dangerous Brook Road crossing, which had claimed at least one life and had injured others in the recent past, nearly claimed another victim that night.
I was hit by a car. They were either playing with a telephone or playing with the radio, and they just weren't paying attention to what they were doing, driving wise. And I saw the headlights at the front of the car and felt it. Next thing I did is feel the bumper.
And you were thrown how far?
35 feet.
Lucky to survive.
Yeah.
So
my chair didn't, but I did, thank goodness.
A decade later, Montgomery became a champion for the cause of improving Brook Road. But where many champions for causes have abandoned their convictions before the near immovable mass of the combined bureaucracies of Henrico County and the Virginia Department of Transportation, Montgomery stuck with it. And during countless planning meetings, 3 governor's administrations, and major state transportation funding cuts, Montgomery's efforts are finally coming to fruition.
It's taken 12 years to get the sidewalk improvement, a new lane on Route 1.
So now you are really just a few months away from it being done. There have been some construction delays, but it looks like they're well underway.
Well, the Brook Road improvements were supposed to be completely finished, construction-wise, by November 20th.
And now they're looking.
And now I understand it's going to be sometime next year before it's all complete.
In July of last year, VDOT started work on a major widening and pedestrian crossing project at Brook Road. It will allow the 80 or so residents of Hollybrook, most of whom rely on wheelchairs to get around, access to the shopping center across the street that they're equally dependent on for food. The project has hit a number of construction delays since it began. Originally slated to be completed in November of this year, VDOT now expects its contractor to wrap up work by March of next year. You've heard of popular events that draw crowds. How about one where crowds draw? Tomorrow, starting at noon, 1708 Gallery's annual Monster Drawing Rally will bring together more than 60 local artists, all creating original works for the holidays. Billed as performance, art bazaar, and Christmas party, the all-day event consists of 4 one-hour shifts, with 16 or more artists drawing simultaneously each hour. The ensuing artwork is then sold as original holiday gifts. Children can create art of their own at the 1708 chalk wall. Admission is $5 and kids are admitted free. For more information on the Monster Drawing Rally, go to 1708gallery.org. Have yourselves a happy Hanukkah, folks.
Last week, proponents of preservation in the Verina District, a historic and still largely rural area of eastern Henrico County, received word that their long efforts of the past 3 years had paid off. The Richmond Regional Planning District Commission, which had undertaken an effort to create a plan for the eventual widening of historic New Market Road, Route 5 to most, had decided to accept their study. That may sound to the lay listener like Route 5 residents should prepare for more traffic, but rather, that's code to mean that the study will be put on a shelf to gather dust. Now Route 5 proponents are moving forward to develop their own plans for preservation. I'm here with Giles Harnsberger, manager at Storefront, a nonprofit design resource center for residents and communities in Richmond, and with Nicole Anderson Ellis, a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and a founding member of the New Market Corridor Coalition that had worked to preserve Route 5. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well.
Excellent. And I guess you're doing better now that you know that Route 5, at least in the short term, is not going to turn into four lanes.
It is a good Christmas present to have at least the effort dialed back for a little while, that we don't have to fight the way we have been.
And you've called upon Giles to hopefully help to make sure that the dial, when it is turned, perhaps is turned in a way that is happy for all listeners?
Well, absolutely, and we're so lucky to have her on board. When I say dialed back, the difference between the way it feels to work on something proactively and enthusiastically and to be making something better versus to be fighting a bad idea, it's just a different energy, and it really generates a lot of enthusiasm, and we're excited about it.
Now, it sounded like that the Richmond Planning District Commission really came to this this process thinking that they were doing the right thing, but really ran into quite a lot of, traffic, I guess.
Well, we were thrilled when they announced this study. The community was absolutely thrilled. We had just finished the comp plan, the 2026 revision of the comprehensive plan for Henrico County. The community in Verina was educated. They were engaged. We were on board. And so we were just shifting our energy from that to this.
And this was 2009, right?
That's exactly right. And we were really excited about proactive planning for growth in this area, and when we found out that this was study was coming out, we contacted the consultants, and then we contacted them again, and then again. And unfortunately, their version of community input was more, we're going to have a website, and then at the end of our two-year study, we're going to ask for your feedback. Our idea of community input was, we've been working on this for some people in the community for decades. We have a very specific vision. We have a very specific inventory of the assets in this community.
You were kind of experts on Route 5 by that point.
I was not, but the people that I was working with were. And we were eager to have that expertise taken advantage of. And regrettably, it wasn't. But in the end, it ended up being a really valuable process because we ended up coming together with a lot of enthusiasm and creating a vision on our own. So we didn't get to partner with the RRPDC as we had hoped to, but we did in the end come together, and they recognized the vision and they made the right decision. So we're very happy about it.
Now, there was something in the comprehensive plan process that I think is probably fairly important to how Giles is coming to the table now. Is that right?
The Absolutely.
The comp plan, which of course was quite comprehensive in terms of how it played out with the Verina community getting involved in the process.
Anyone who has been involved in a comp plan revision process knows it is a huge undertaking in terms of staff and time and money for the county, but also in terms of the residents and the democratic process. It is when you get input from everybody in the area about the way you want the area to look through 2026. And one of the things that the community and the county agreed on was that there are certain parts of the county that have extraordinary value in terms of their tourism potential and their beauty. there are five what are called special character protection areas in Enrico County. Four of them fall within the Newmarket corridor. They are the community of Marion Hill, which is a hill, a neighborhood just east of Churchill and Fulton Hill. And then Newmarket Road itself, the Newmarket Road Corridor, the Osborne Turnpike Corridor, and then the James River Corridor. So all four of those are right in Verina, right east of downtown.
And this is the area, if you're in the city and you're looking down from Church Hill, some of this you're seeing, and this is the
Absolutely.
These beautiful historic vistas that Richmonders are talking about all the
it
time these days.
It is the gateway to Richmond from the East End and from Williamsburg.
Williamsburg.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. And
these so now
areas,
these four areas, when the county was talking with the citizens about how to move forward with implementing the comp plan, it was agreed to that in that process there would be an adoption of some guidelines?
Well, what it means to be a special character protection area is that any development in these areas has to meet specific guidelines. But those guidelines were never set. There's some general language in the comp plan that was agreed to and voted in.
By the Board of Supervisors.
By the Board of Supervisors, with the support of the community. But the specific details of what that design would look like and those criteria were never set. So 3 years later, development is still coming into this corridor, and they have, in some cases, and we've had specific situations within the last few years where developers don't even know that they've bought a piece of property that's in a special character protection area.
Oops.
Right. So it's a waste of time.
And that's really not fair to the developer either.
It's not fair to the developer. It's a waste of their time. It's a waste of their money. It's not fair to the community because we're having to leave our families at night to go and explain things in a county venue that we think should be common knowledge. And so that's where Giles comes in.
Our second guest arrives.
Exactly.
Yes.
Giles, you're again with Storefront. And Storefront was founded about 2 years ago? 3 years?
2011. February 14th.
Yeah, 2 years ago, and, yep. And it came together around, again, we were talking about this earlier, Union Hill?
That's right. Yep, Union Hill was made a city old and historic district, and Councilperson Cynthia Newbill was really concerned that people in the neighborhood would have the resource or, you know, the connection with people who knew sort of about what kind of guidelines.
And in fact,
necessary.
This was part of the compromise, I guess, to that
That's
brought
correct.
About Union
That's
Hill
correct.
Becoming that.
Yep, and it was very critical to our founding that Dr. Newbill thought that was so important. So we have a couple of people who are, you know, on that board, the CAR, on the board of directors at Storefront. Anyway, so
and
what they do
CAR
is
the CAR again is the
Commission of Architectural Review at yeah. the City of Richmond. So so when when residents from those neighborhoods face hardship or just don't know what to do in terms of renovating their home. To the standards and the CAR guidelines, they're able to make an appointment through Storefront to talk to someone who can advise them about that. So that was part of the initiation of Storefront. But now we do quite a lot more, and we're really excited to work with Nicole and the coalition.
And this is sort of a unique undertaking too, as I understand it from talking with you earlier. It sounds like doing rural guidelines and trying to come up with ideas
right.
that are design guidelines for a rural area, very different obviously than
yeah.
an urban area.
Yeah, we just did sidewalk cafe guidelines for the city of Richmond, and that was sort of a nice pilot project. And what my job is the manager, is to pull in planners, urban planners, pull in architects, graphic designers, all kinds of design professionals to work on these plans. And it's very collaborative, and it's all done by those folks, by the professionals in a pro bono capacity, which is fantastic. It gives them the opportunity to give back. And I think there's a market for that,
probably
actually.
To try some really new and interesting things, too.
Totally. Yeah. It's very exciting. So, and what's also nice is that they're working on giving a voice to the community. And in this case, there are many communities involved and many stakeholders. So luckily, they've been doing a lot of the groundwork before we've been involved. So we're excited.
So have we got any idea of what sort of design concepts we're trying to put in place out there at this point? I mean,
yeah.
presumably it's to sort of keep, again, this rural feel, wood fences, etc.
There are people in Verina. I mean, the fact that we have something out there worth saving is really a credit to a number of factors. Part of it's luck that development went west first. But a lot of it is people, Verona Beautification Committee as an example, people who've been working for decades to protect the historic assets, the visual assets, and the agricultural value of this community. Every time I talk about this issue, I feel compelled to say agriculture is Virginia's number one industry by far and growing, and tourism is number two and growing. And what the history that we have in Verina includes some of the most famous names
Pocahontas,
in American history. You've heard me
John
say
Rolfe.
Pocahontas, John Rolfe, John Smith.
Washington, George
some of
Washington.
The most famous Lincoln, of course. Anytime he went to and from Williamsburg, sure. He was going through Verina. So there is so much opportunity for economic development in these areas, and the residents of the communities have been looking for ways to have there be growth that does not destroy that economic development potential.
First college charter in the New World, too.
That's exactly right.
So just all
first
kinds
tobacco.
Of really, first tobacco.
A lot of firsts.
In fact, really, that is why we're here today. First tobacco.
That's
without
exactly
it,
right.
we would not be here. So again, I'm here with Nicole Anderson Ellis, who's a Route 5 preservationist, and Giles Harnsberger, who's with Storefront. Storefront, again, is going to be trying to create some guidelines for how Route 5 is going to look.
Right. But it's important to say that those guidelines are not coming from Storefront. Storefront is kind of a collaborative process. It's,
sure.
You know, it brings people together.
You're bringing in the architects and the planners.
Well, yes, and the community to talk about what's appropriate. Because if it doesn't come from the residents or the people that care,
then you're back where you started.
Exactly, exactly. Then nobody likes Storefront anymore. We're not biased in any way. So
is the plan to move forward with some sort of community meetings to start?
Yes.
Okay. And when do we expect those to start happening?
I believe January is the first one that Storefront will be involved with, and that's with a steering committee that's been charged with creating these guidelines.
Okay, so this is not an open meeting for the public yet.
The meetings have been going on. The New Market Corridor Coalition has a subcommittee on special character design, and they have been meeting, but the kind of what we're celebrating today is the fact that Giles is on board, because what the community knows how to do is how to communicate their vision. They know what they want. What they don't know how to do is to translate that into language that the county could actually adopt.
Right.
And so it's a real stumbling block when you go to planners and say, we want this, and that's not the language that they use. It's not what would be appropriate to be adopted as code. So we have this great opportunity to talk to Giles and her team and say, all right, this is the vision. We want setbacks. We want clustering. We want conservation subdivisions. We want to balance agriculture and residential. We want to maintain the open landscapes along the roadway. And then Giles has the knowledge and the tools to say, okay, well then.
Right. And then we also vet it with the community. I mean, outreach is a huge part. And I realize I say the community, and we're talking about a very diverse group of neighborhoods on Route 5 and all the way down into Richmond. But we, you know, we put it online and we take comments and we try to make people aware that it's going on. So that's an essential part of it.
So is this likely to get all the way down into from as I don't know, as meta as we want setbacks, to as detailed as this is the sort of shingles that you're going to use, or?
I think we would talk about building materials.
Right. And I was, shingles was just, came
it,
to mind.
Just like, yeah.
Siding, and we don't want vinyl that looks like it's made from Legos that were melted down. We want wood siding or things like this.
Right, that's correct. Just to maintain sort of a quality control.
One of the things that the community has learned just through this process and trying to educate ourselves about land use and about design, I'd like to point out that I knew none of this before I moved to Verina and all of a sudden kind of was thrown in on the front lines of suburban sprawl, that when it comes to tourism, what a community looks like is essential in determining whether or not people will go out of their way to visit it, no matter whatever happened there. People are not going to go to yet another subdivision. It doesn't matter what event took place there. So keeping a landscape that looks like part of tourism, what's essential in drawing people, especially to historic tourism, is that they can imagine what life was like then. So they want to go to a place and imagine what it was like for Pocahontas. What did she see? What did John Rolfe see? What did his farm look like? And if there are, and what they drive through on their way there and on their way home is part of that experience. So we're not talking about big houses or necessarily small houses. We're not talking about the specifics about what they look like, but just that there is a feeling that is aesthetic and appealing.
And there are probably parts of that drive up from Williamsburg that look very much like that area might have
absolutely
looked.
Williamsburg has done generally a really good job of this, particularly around their historic assets.
So in terms of process moving forward, we have this steering committee.
Right.
And once that's come up, I'm presuming with some general guidelines, then you'll have some dates moving forward for the broader community to start getting together to voice their opinions.
We have reached out to Tyrone Nelson, who has been an extraordinary supporter of, I mean, he was the one who when the community was dissatisfied with the Route 5 study options, he was the one who said, look, if you're going to ask me to say no to something, give me something to say yes to. He has been a huge supporter of the democratic process and really having the vision for the community be community-based. And I sent him an email today before coming here that said, you know, we're thrilled. We have Giles Harnsberger on board and we have Storefront on board. And we'd like to meet with you in February and talk to you about where we are.
This will be the yes for him to say yes to.
That's the idea, is hopefully that what we're doing will require zero staff time, zero money from the county. And we're not expecting that this will be adopted as is, but right, rather that it will be the document that we can then work with in Redco County and work with the planning staff and figure out, take that and make it part of their plan.
Giles, is this something that we've seen done elsewhere, where you're adopting rural guidelines rather than urban? I know that I've seen certainly Urban Guide Car deals with urban guidelines.
Sure.
Have we seen anything like this?
I haven't seen it at Storefront, but it's the process that we do that I've seen before and that I'm comfortable with and that I'm excited about utilizing for the area, especially to sort of protect, you know, the neighborhood's interests. But I guess you're saying it's unprecedented?
Yeah, is it?
Well, I guess in the Richmond area it is. I don't think we've had a design resource center ever in the past. I do think that there's always been the potential for it, and I think this is a really exciting time. I think during the master plan process, Rachel Flynn really ushered in a time where citizens were much more active in planning for the city. And a lot of people who are interested in this corridor, you know, they're not all residents of the city. Some of them are, mm-hmm. but they're all interested in the way that the city develops. And I love that we're in the position now to bring people the tools so that they can actually take part in that. Because with these guidelines that have not yet been introduced and, you know, there are no planning documents that incorporate these guidelines, obviously, the citizens and the interest groups will be able to take part. And I love that. It's all about participation.
I feel like I should mention, since you mentioned her name, Rachel Flynn being the much celebrated former, was she planning director, I believe, of the city of Richmond, who worked so hard on the, I guess, the riverfront plan and the comprehensive plan for the city. And yeah, really, I mean, the way she brought people together is, I guess it's kind of changed the way we plan.
I think it has. I think she created a real constituency. And I think the current director, Mark Olinger, is building on that a lot. He's been very active and plugged into issues that people are worried about. He's the one who requested the sidewalk cafe guidelines so that we could have a more vital downtown. And he recently, the riverfront plan was adopted,
which, you know, I think actually played somewhat into the decision by the planning district probably to abandon plans, right?
He actually, exactly. The Richmond Planning Commission officially rejected both of the options that were in the Route 5 study.
Right. I think it's an exciting time to be a Richmonder.
Exciting time to be a Richmonder, and especially probably for Giles Harnsberger, who's manager of Storefront and is getting ready to help Nicole Anderson Ellis and the other folks along Route 5.
And I do need to interject here that the coalition...
But wait.
It is resident-based, and the community has been so organized, but the coalition, the Newmarket Corridor Coalition, is not just the neighborhood associations in Verina, which it is. It's also the Churchill Associations, the Greater Fulton Hill Neighborhood Association.
Yeah, this is
Shacklebottom businesses.
The people who are affected.
All of the people who are affected, but also from a regional and statewide level, Scenic Virginia, Preservation Virginia, Historic Richmond Foundation, the Virginia Bicycling Federation, that there are so many stakeholders involved here who come from it with different focuses and different perspectives, but all recognize the value in this corridor and the importance of making wise choices.
And I'd like to thank the Academy and Nicole Anderson Ellis, again, who's a Route 5 corridor.
Amen.
I don't know what to even call you. Somebody who's really been a champion.
I'm a fan.
Huge fan of Route 5. And again, Giles Harnsberger. Thank you guys for coming.
Thanks, Chris.
All right.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
Philosopher Epicetus thought that sporting a beard was something sacred, a signal that the art of thinking was such a serious matter to the philosopher that it would affect his time for shaving. Men who sport facial hair have been extolled for possessing such virtues as wisdom, sexual virility, masculinity, even a higher status. On the other side of the face, men with beards have also been seen as careless, unrefined, and even dirty. The popularity of facial hair comes and goes. The history of bearddom in Europe is a particularly fascinating roller coaster ride, but there's a whole new movement to champion the furry chins and the whiskered lips of today's beard wearers. Organizations and even beard competitions have sprouted up in the past few years. Richmond's own RVA Beard League is one of the most active of these hair-first groups. It's a founding member of the North American Competitive Beard and Mustache Alliance, and the newest North American member of the World Beard and Mustache Association. Its members meet twice a month at gatherings open to the public, and they help to sponsor charity events, like the upcoming Winter Soul Stash, happening at Mekong on December 20th. We are pleased today to be joined by three enthusiastic ambassadors of the RVA Beard League. We're going to talk about the league and also talk in general about the timeless allure of face follicles. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, sir.
Can you introduce yourselves to everyone?
My name is Travis Oliver. I am the treasurer of the group.
Treasurer of the Beard League.
My name is Robert Del Follicle, and I'm the secretary.
Okay, Robert.
And I'm Chad Roberts. I'm the president and founder.
All right. Well, you know, I got to say, the facial hair here on display is absolutely majestic.
Thank you.
We have several different styles here. We'll try to describe them in a bit. From going all over to the very understated, Robert. How long are your beards and when did you begin to grow them? Travis?
My beard measures right about 12, 13 inches. And I started growing it 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't cut it, trimmed it, touched it since then.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Just general maintenance, basically.
Nothing that involves a razor or scissors. Keep it clean and keep it nice, but nothing
right.
Nothing involves sharp edges.
And the man with the mustache, Robier.
I first started growing a mustache in 2010, but kept it deliberately short and creepy.
Mm-hmm.
About last October, I started pursuing the handlebar.
Right.
So it's a little over 14 months.
That is a hard style to rock, but I got to say you do it.
Thank you.
Chad, what about you?
I've been growing mine for a little over 2 years now, and it's, I guess, about a foot long or so.
Wow. How many members are in the RVA Beard League? How many total? Chad, you're the president.
There's a greater group of over 100, and then there's a core of about 20 to 30, depending on the event and all that.
Mm-hmm. When did the league start? When did you begin?
Started last June, over a year ago, so what, year and a half now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You guys have a lot of events, a lot of charity events, included. Well, you have twice monthly events at Station 2, is
right.
That correct?
Yeah, well, we have once monthly at Station 2.
Oh, okay.
We do our kind of social pub night at Station 2 the second Monday of every month, but then we also have a business meeting once a month, which is open to the public still. We typically have it at a member's house to try to make it a more focused atmosphere.
Right. Now, are there dues?
There are no dues. No.
No dues.
We don't, totally free.
Yeah, okay. We don't want there to be any barriers, so there's no dues. You don't even have to have facial hair, as long as you have a healthy appreciation for facial hair.
Right, I was going to say, you may need some women to come along.
Yeah, we've got plenty. We've got the
My wife's a member, his girlfriend's a member.
That's great.
The term is whiskerina. Yeah.
Whiskerina.
Whiskerina.
Female enthusiasts who sometimes craft fake beards and mustaches.
Wow. Well, I know they appreciate that. But you do all these events, but your big event comes in April, right? You do the Mid-Atlantic Beard and Stash Competition?
Right, yeah. So we do a lot of different charity events, volunteer work throughout the year. But our big event is the annual Mid-Atlantic Beard and Stash Championship. So this will be our second year. This 2013. 2012, we did it in March. We moved it to April for 2013 just to kind of get it out of the way of some other stuff. But it's a huge event. We had, I think, people from 8 states at the 2012. I think we've already got 10 states signed up for 2013.
Yep. Wow.
We sold out our venue last year, had to turn away a few hundred people. So we've pretty much doubled the size of the venue, doubled up everything. So it's a big event. The money from 2012 went to the food bank.
Right.
2013, it's going towards Big Brother, Big Sister of Greater Richmond. So it's a big charity event. It's our big charity event. We love having people come in from out of town and show them around and then give money to people. So,
well, let's pull back for a second. When did the idea of having pro-beard organizations and even competitions, when did that come about? Has that been a relatively recent phenomenon?
It's been around more in Germany and Europe for years past, but it's a relatively new phenomenon in America.
Mm-hmm.
But I started mostly as a social group.
Right.
As a kind of birds of a feather sort of club. And we all had kind of the same goals and wanted to make our hometown a better place because we were here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started wanting to do community service events and volunteer work and just kind of making Richmond a better place to live.
So it's not just getting together and hoisting a couple. You're doing
That is a part. Don't get me
wrong.
That
is a part of it. Yeah, okay.
A big dynamic is drinking beer.
But right. We can be
you
productive,
must,
too.
So much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, the main core of what we do is really to give back to the community and present a positive face for people, no pun intended, positive, you know, face for people in the community of us that have facial hair. Because there is those misconceptions that are sometimes negative, and we want to show people that they're misconceptions.
Right. Well, talk a little bit about these competitions. What are you being judged on? Is it length? Is it appearance?
Such a tricky question.
because a beard is in the eye of the beholder.
It's a very subjective activity. You know, every different competition has different categories and criteria. But for the most part, in most categories, you're looking at things like length and girth and overall. Does it fit the person that's wearing it? Then there's other categories like Chad competes in freestyle, which is basically where you do crazy things with your beard, make it into shapes.
Like
or
what,
designs.
Chad? What are you doing crazy
with your beard? I've done loop-de-loops. I've done an X-Wing fighter once, actually twice. But just kind of fun, creative ways to kind of show off a beard.
Right, right. Well, I recently grew my beard. Now, is this called a full circle? Well, what is this called?
It's essentially a goatee for competition purposes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I must admit, I do feel more virile.
I mean,
I mean, I feel, and then Charles Darwin said that facial hair was a part of the sexual selection process and that women are more attracted to men with facial hair. My question to you is, do you know of any scientific evidence to support that, or is that just Charles just going off?
Only anecdotally.
Yeah. Right.
Anecdotally, it's been a very sort of almost a polar issue. Either women really, really like it, or they just don't care for it at all. And so it's almost like a crunchy versus smooth peanut butter sort of situation. There are those who do, and then there are those who don't, and there are plenty of those that do.
And I personally like to think that those who don't, it's more of a cultural conditioning as opposed to, I think if they really got to their core instincts, they would probably be all about it. So
cool.
And I think to some extent it's also a generational issue. Like I know of my parents' generation, there is a lot of the anti-Vietnam protesters and the hippies.
Or even the Beat Generation.
Exactly. And so they had this negative connotation growing up, and they had almost a 50s style a man should be clean shaven and look like this and that.
Right.
And so I think we're kind of coming about on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially here in Richmond, Talk a bit about Richmond's love of facial hair. Is it just me, or is there an awful lot of men with facial hair around here?
It's a great city for it.
You were telling me that several of the RVA Beard League members were involved in the Lincoln shooting of the movie Lincoln.
There were a number of pre-existing members that were in Lincoln, and then, of course, it gave us ample grounds for recruiting because there was a lot of facial hair. But yeah, it was kind of funny because when you get in these conversations when you're on set with people, and one of the things that they told us kind of was that one of the reasons they came to Richmond was because finding extras in Los Angeles that had the facial hair that they needed to support the entire extra cast was virtually impossible. They would have had to spend a lot of money and a lot of time because everybody in Los Angeles evidently doesn't really do beards because they have that clean slate kind of thing.
Right. Well, we can owe all of this economic benefit.
Yeah. How many millions is
our
it now?
Bearded population.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I like that. Yeah, I like that too. A lot. Let's talk a little bit about the many types of beards there are. They're available in all shapes and sizes. I'll throw out a couple of terms I've heard, and some of them I'm not sure I understand, and you can help me describe what they are. How's that?
All right. Sounds great.
Okay, you start with mine. You say this is for a competition. This is a goatee.
Yeah. Goatee, a Van Dyke.
Yeah. Okay. What is a soul patch?
A soul patch is a square of hair beneath your bottom lip. Okay. No mustache. No sideburns.
Well, okay. That's it. Very understated.
Half of what Frank
said. As minimalistic as it gets.
What about the Royale? Have you ever heard of the Royale?
It's a new term for me.
I'm not familiar.
Let's invent what it is.
The Royale?
What could the Royale be?
I'd almost say like a...
What, Samuel Jackson wore in Pulp Fiction?
Could only be found in Studio 54.
Maybe a Musketeer-esque? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Or... I don't know.
What about the Garibaldi? Do we know what the Garibaldi?
That's the one I heard. The Garibaldi is it's a shorter beard, typically 8 to 10 inches, very very rounded, very big
kind of like like a nice bottom lobe, almost like a pear shape on your face.
Yeah.
Okay. Another term I've heard for that is the beehive.
The beehive. Yeah. Okay.
It's a very like full bodied shaped kind of beard.
Mm-hmm. The Garibaldi sounds much more. I don't know. Weighty somehow. What about the chin strap? That seems like it could be
like an Amish style or a Donegal. It's also called an Alaskan whaler. Typically, people associate with Abraham Lincoln.
Right. I rocked that one time. I called it the C. Everett Coupe.
Oh.
I had
how wonky of you.
It was very historical. It was hysterical actually. Let's see. What about talk about the goatee a little bit. It seems like the goatee has a lot of different variations.
There is. The goatee, in competition, the goatee is a much more general term. It really kind of denotes anything that is not connected by sideburns to the top of your kind of face. Mm-hmm. So it's really anything mustache, beard I'm gesturing like everyone can see me, but I mean, it's not connected by sideburns.
Travis, what is the name of your beard? Is it called a full beard?
Yeah, I have a full beard, and I compete in full beard natural. So I mean, I'm pretty much as basic, true to the soil as you get.
Is there a full beard unnatural?
Well, that would be like styled or groomed freestyle.
Oh, okay. So your full beard.
Usually the categories are. Natural and like a styled category. So if you add any sort of products like mustache wax or, in my case, hairspray or any sort of gel, any sort of like products to hold or shape it, that's considered a styled.
Yeah. And you can do a lot with the full beard. There's really kind of three pieces of facial hair. There's the sideburns, the mustache, and the beard. And a full beard is you have the entire package. There's no missing parts, and then partial beards kind of either you don't have a mustache, you don't have the sideburns, or you have sideburns and no kind of beard on your chin type situation. So,
Robiere, there's a mustache competition, I'm guessing?
Big competitions, you're either in mustache natural or mustache styled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there like a style. Snidely whiplash sort of a, you're tying the girl to the railroad track sort of a
I've been called snidely before.
Have you really?
Smaller competitions that are less formal, more for... Uh-huh. Fun and camaraderie. There are a lot of specific mustache categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've seen them really bushy. I mean really bushy. To the point where, how do you get food in there? Sort of bushy.
Carefully.
You know, I really can't relate to the big bushy ones.
No, you've got sort of the understated.
You learn to open your jaw.
Yeah. Right, right.
And
right.
Straws are your best friend.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let me ask you really, this question you got. Have you ever found something in there and you didn't know how it got in there? Travis and Chad.
No, I haven't. The good thing about a beard is that it grows slow, so you can kind of adjust to it and learn how to eat and drink and do all the things you need to do as it grows. So you don't find that very often. Yeah. I've never found anything in my beard.
No. Rule of thumb's about half an inch a month, and yeah, I haven't found anything. I haven't discovered anything.
Right, right.
Maybe one day.
They got in there during the night or something.
Maybe there's like 20 back there somewhere.
On account of the wax, I once had a cupcake sprinkle lodged in my mustache for a few hours at work.
Oh,
no one cared to mention it to me. It was just a neon blue speck hanging out.
I think you need to talk to your coworkers about that. That could have been a setup.
They're out to get me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the events that y'all do. You do the mustache competition, the championship, but what about the Winter Solstash? And you said you had a toy drive coming up.
Yeah, so next week is a busy week for us. We've got our Christmas party, which is a ugly sweater / gift exchange / toy drive, emphasis on the toy drive part, at Wonderland. And that's on the 19th, which is Wednesday, I believe. And then Solstash isn't technically our event. They've been doing it at Mekong for a few years now, but it is a great event. It's one that we hugely support. There's a lot of charity involved with that. It's put on by Derek, who's a great guy, does an amazing job with it. And it's something that we participate in heavily. We try to get as many people out there as possible and really make it something special for everybody. But, a large part of what we do with our events is really try to get that charity aspect. We do a lot of community volunteering. We've adopted two roads, one in the city, one in Henrico.
Oh, okay.
We did a Habitat for Humanity this year build. We did Hands on Greater Richmond when they did that, helped clean up Carytown. So that's a big part of what we do. So
and then the Winter Solstash is for
prostate cancer
research.
So there's
right.
that. And then, like I said, we're doing the toy drive is a big part of our event next week as well. And then, as I mentioned earlier, our event in April will go towards Big Brother, Big Sister.
Great.
So it's a large part of what we're about.
I guess I didn't ask how many total members of the group, of the Beard League?
Like Chad said, it's we've got about 120 greater members, but about 20 to 30 really active people that come out when it's important. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking with, the guys at the RVA Beard League. The group's annual Winter Solstash is planned for December 20th at Mekong, a charity event benefiting prostate cancer research. And upcoming in April, the league's big Mid-Atlantic Beard and Stash competition will commence. More information, go to beardleague.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Happy holidays, you guys. Thanks for coming on Open Source RVA and allowing us to be in the presence of your awesome beards and mustaches.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Broadcast of WRAR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
Late last month, the Wingnut Anarchist Collective received an unexpected and early Christmas gift from an anonymous source, a found computer thumb drive containing what since then in court has been alleged to be confidential information belonging to the Richmond Police Department. The weeks since the drive was found, and portions of it published on the Wingnut's website, have been interesting for the Wingnut and its most prominent member, Mo Karn. A very broad court injunction, since determined to be overbroad by the court, was issued, and police, in an effort to serve it, deployed their forces en masse, some in tactical gear, but seemingly with the design of impressing people like Mo Karn's mother. WRIR itself was a receiver of one such visit by four plainclothes police detectives more than a week after Karn and an anonymous individual who found the drive appeared on Open Source RVA. Also in that time, Karn has procured the assistance of a lawyer, Andrew Bodo, with the firm of Thomas H. Roberts and Associates. I'm with Andrew T. Bodo, and he is a lawyer with the firm of Thomas H. Roberts and Associates, and he is representing Mo Karn and I believe another defendant in the current action against the Wingnut and some members of that anarchist collective who are accused of obtaining somehow falsely or otherwise a thumb drive containing Richmond Police Department files. And here to talk with you a little bit about what the case means and where you guys are going with it and what the implications might be.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Thank you
for being here. Can you tell me, I guess, a little bit about what, first of all, is on this thumb drive, allegedly?
Well, essentially, the Commonwealth or the Richmond Police Department has not really identified what's on this thumb drive. Their allegations in their complaint and in their amended complaint simply identify this thumb drive is containing what they call confidential information, which they then define as the contact information for officers and employees of the Richmond Police Department. They allege that some of these officers and employees are undercover officers, but they don't indicate how many of these documents contain this so-called confidential information, or the scope of the confidential information in this, whether this is one officer's name, several officers' names, whether this is the entire department. They simply don't identify with any precision the contents of this thumb drive.
Now, we had Mo and a gentleman who identified himself to us as John Q. Public recently, and they were discussing this after the initial action against them by Richmond Police, which was serving an order to essentially cease and desist in what they were up to, which was an interest in publishing the department's protocols, and evidently that is on the thumb drive.
Yes, I understand from Mo Karn, our client, as well as from Nathan Cox, that the bulk of the documents on this or that were published online were documents concerning the general policies and procedures of the Richmond Police Department, and their only purpose for linking to these documents was because they thought that these documents were a matter of public concern. They had indicated, as I think they indicated in the radio program, that they were not aware of any documents containing this confidential information, as they call it. It remains to be seen to what extent any of this confidential information was actually published.
Okay, and in fact, I guess that the protocols were the subject of a previous headline-making news event, so to speak, a protracted headline-making news event where the Wingnut had published those documents that they had received through a Freedom of Information Act. The department says that it was an accidental release of those documents, but what ended up happening was the court determined that, in fact, they could keep them.
Yeah, as I recall that case, court actually didn't have to make that determination because as soon as the lawyers got involved in favor of Mo Karn, the Richmond Police Department dropped the case.
They just simply walked away from their claim. Since then, Mo told us on the radio that she had been FOIAing for the remainder of these documents that they had not received through the FOIA request. There were certain things that were not necessarily exempted, but just simply they had not provided the complete document, and she'd said that these were on there. Is there any thought in this case of how RPD and their failure to answer her FOIA requests since the initial FOIA was responded to might play into what's currently happening or happening
well,
going on?
At this point, the prior responses under FOIA are not so much of our concern. However, any time that the the government fails in its obligations to respond under FOIA, allows the citizen to obtain what's called a writ of mandamus, ordering the public body to turn the documents over. And our firm has handled a couple mandamus actions of this sort in the past. We actually have one going up to the Supreme Court currently that may actually impact this case.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, essentially, one of the provisions of the Virginia FOIA make it clear that, as a general rule, personnel documents, personnel files of government employees are not subject to disclosure under FOIA. But there's a separate provision that seems to govern law enforcement personnel files that would make these law enforcement personnel files subject to disclosure under FOIA. And it would make this requirement that chiefs of police release their personnel files upon request superior to the general exemption or general exception. In this particular case, the confidential information, as it's been defined within the complaint, seems to be these law enforcement personnel files that are subject to being to disclosure upon the mere request of any citizen. So it seems extraordinary that the Richmond Police Department can claim that this is somehow injuring the public when they're required to disclose this material and this information upon a request by a citizen.
Okay. I'm here with Andrew Bodo, and he is an attorney who's representing right now Mo Karn and members of the Wingnut Collective, and we're talking a little bit about what's been happening with their case, recent discovery of a thumb drive with some information that Richmond Police Department wants back and has taken action to return. Can you tell me, with regards to the case right now, just again a little bit of an update on where it might go from here?
Sure. The action got started, of course, by the filing of this complaint and the temporary injunction, which our clients weren't even a part of at that time. It was only the Richmond Police Department standing in front of the judge presenting evidence to obtain this injunction. Since then, we have entered the case and entered the case with force in order to try to have that injunction dissolved, as well as to have this entire case dismissed as a violation of the First Amendment and on several other bases. So at this point, the court has now entered a much more narrow temporary injunction, or at least much more specific temporary injunction, defining with some clarity the documents that may not be disclosed at this point. And in addition to that, the court has decided to hold a hearing in a few weeks as to whether or not the entire injunction would be dissolved. At that point, because an injunction can be appealed to the Supreme Court, we may look at the option of appealing this even before it goes to trial.
We had a recent visit from Richmond Police Department based on our previous broadcast where we had Mo and again, John Q. Public, who we don't know. It was four plainclothes detectives who they identified themselves that way, and they came to the station late at night and were seeking things like video surveillance, et cetera. Evidently, in serving a lot of these, the original injunction, there was something of a serious show of force by the department that I believe during a previous conversation, it was either with you or with your partner, Mr. Roberts, you were saying there might be some questionable aspects to the show of force in serving these documents.
Yes, there's two different concerns. First of all, what we're dealing with here is a potential violation of the First Amendment. It's our position that this injunction, it constitutes a prior restraint on freedom of speech, which is the essence of what the First Amendment protects. So not only the injunction itself, but then any attempts to bolster the force or of this injunction by the display of force could constitute further chilling effect upon the public's First Amendment rights. Especially since there are 10 unidentified plaintiffs who could be anybody, and anyone could be added to this suit. In addition to that...
I spoke to one individual who had a number of officers show up, one in tactical gear, to serve this piece of paper to him, or actually they were seeking the person that they needed to serve it to. It was not serving him. They were simply looking for the individual. So you're saying that showing up that way by sort of expressing that potential force behind it might be a coercion?
It definitely has objective elements of coercion, or at least objective elements of raising fear. And if it was intended, as a tactic in order to discourage people from talking about these documents, it definitely raises First Amendment concerns. The other side of the issue is that, as a general rule, court documents are supposed to be served either by the sheriff or some party or some individual who is not a party to the lawsuit. In this case, the police decided, apparently, to have these documents served by its own officers, its own agents, which raises concerns about the manner of the service of process. And this is precisely why the Virginia Code has rules about who may serve and who may not serve these documents, is in order to prevent the sort of fear and intimidation that can arise if the opposing party is the one to hand you these documents.
When are you guys in court next, if there is a date?
We don't have a date set at this point. We expect it to be sometime in mid to late January.
Okay. Thank you again for being here. And it's Andrew Bodo, who's again with the law firm of Thomas H. Roberts and Associates, and you're defending Mokarn and the Wingnut and 10 people you haven't met yet. Thank you again for being here.
You're welcome. No problem.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums, ready to race to you.
And that's our show for December 14th, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey, Amy Daniel, and Mike McKenzie. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op is the not-so-ever-present Rachel Solomon. Hey, did you know that we podcast all of our episodes? Go to rvaopensource.com and get the lowdown. And stay tuned for next week's very special Christmas episode of Open Source RVA. We promise not to jump the shark. Until then, have a great weekend and be good to yourselves. This is Open Source RVA signing off.
What a day.